Podcast One presents the Steve Austin Show Classics.
All right, everybody, the conversation continues. We're sitting there drinking Buffalo Bill Cody beer. When I say we, I'm talking with Eric Bischoff. He was right in the middle of the story. We cut off on Tuesday's edition of the Steve Austin Show. Cliffhanger. You're there talking about how to make WCW being able to compete with WWF at the time and how you were able to get that job.
Yeah, I mean, it was a couple different things. It wasn't one vision, but it was, number one, you know, we were perceived to be very Southern, very regional, and we had to overcome that stigma. And that meant we had to change a number of things. Graphics, just the visual look of the show. It had to be a little slicker. Prior to that, Bill Watts was going to go the other way. Pull back the ring mats, go old school, make it look like a little
TV
studio.
And we did pull those ring mats back.
And we did.
All of a sudden, we start falling on concrete, and you talk about bullshit. I mean,
it was bad.
I'll say that because that's what it was, man. When you go crashing outside the ring, you need a little bit of padding to keep your ass safe. So none of the boys like that.
And the product suffered as a result of that.
It looked like hell.
It did. So my approach was, let's raise up the lights. Let's make the crowd a bigger part of the show. Let's make the announcers sound a little less Southern. Let's get away from the Southern style creative. Less gimmicks, less pokey pokey stuff. No mummies, no hunchbacks.
But when you say Southern style, you think that was Southern style?
It was more so than what I was used to.
Or maybe regional.
Well, regional.
To your point, regional.
Regional.
Okay.
Yeah, more so than what I was used to growing up in Detroit and Minneapolis. So it was a combination of a lot of that. And, you know, that put me in direct conflict with a lot of people that were from that market.
Jim Ross has a very Southern voice. How did that resonate with him? First of all, I mean, like, when you got the job, I mean, he ended up leaving the company, right?
Shortly thereafter.
Man, did you ever talk? I know you're going to be on his podcast here in the near future. You know, Jim's show is on Podcast One, The Ross Report. It's an outstanding podcast. You can all check it out. I know you're going to talk with him in the near future. And you guys are going to cover a lot of this, but we're coming right now. So when you got that job, I mean, that had to be, sticking his craw.
Yeah, and I can't speak for Jim, but it was tense.
Yeah, correct.
It was tense. It was not a pretty situation. I'm sure we'll go into it more on his show, but because I want to hear from him, actually. We've never really talked about that. You know,
how close were you guys? I mean, because, I said on the, before I, opened my show and I was talking about as long as I've known you, this is, or the close of my show, whatever it was, as long as we've known each other, this is the longest we've ever really sat down and talked with each other, for the most part.
For the most part, about business especially. Yeah, I think we had a couple of nights and a couple of Marriotts after,
after
the show.
Absolutely.
But that was like half an hour over beers, but
nothing
like this, no.
Yeah. So how close were you ever in your relationship with a professional relationship with Jim Ross?
Never.
Y'all ever buddies? Y'all never had a drink or hung out together? Nothing?
Nah, we might have had a cocktail or two as a part of a larger group, but we never went out and had a beer.
But just, you wouldn't consider yourself buds?
No.
Right. So he goes, he leaves, and that's when he goes to WWF, right?
Yep. He went to and I remember, and I don't remember all the details of it specifically, but I remember there was, do we let him go, do we not let him go? And it's like, dude, he wants to go. Let him go, man. Let him do his thing.
Right. And so then did this had Schiavone applied for this role?
I believe so. I knew the executive producer role we were talking about on Tuesday's show. There was a couple people internally, and there was also some people from New York that had outside of wrestling, television executive producer experience that had applied. And I think for whatever reason, someday interview Bill Shaw, he'll tell you, but they rolled the dice on me.
So then
everything changed. It changed a lot. Now, I didn't have complete control at that time. There was a guy by the name of Bob Dew who was in charge of wrestling operations. So he was in charge of the business side, syndication, international sales, home video, live events, which was a big issue. He was in charge of that side of the business. I was in charge of the television side of the business, which included talent, creative, what we saw, anything you saw on television, I was in charge of. And that worked for a period of time.
But you had to have been in charge of, certainly with your experience in AWA, syndication sales, stick work, coming up to WCW, C-level announcer, by your own words, and all of a sudden, you're in a spot where you're the guy, damn near the main guy. So you're in uncharted waters. Because here you got a great pitch. Now you got to execute this pitch. So, I mean, dude,
that was a little challenging.
Tell me about navigating those waters, because all of a sudden, okay, yeah, I understand you're in charge of television, but there's a lot more to it than just saying, in charge of television and talent. First of all, you got the title, you got the job, you're the guy. Did you have to earn respect, or did the respect come as soon as you
got
that?
And Steve, you were part of it. You were there at that time. I knew. I was smart enough to know. I was still green in the business, relatively speaking.
Right.
People would act one way to your face,
right,
and they would be as polite or respectful as they needed to be at that moment to get through the day and to keep what they had. But I knew I had no respect, or very little, from very few of the talent. Because in their minds, never been in the ring, wasn't a wrestling guy, was a pretty boy announcer, just got thrust into the job. So I knew I was in for a world of crap.
But just as far as the day-to-day workings of things, you certainly had to navigate through different things that you'd never been through before.
But that wasn't that hard for me, to be honest with you. Business is business.
Right,
you know?
Gotcha.
On the business side of things, people were so afraid. Because, when I took – at that point, WCW was a company that was grossing $25 million a year, and it was losing $10 or $12 million a year in the process. Everybody knew that it was just a matter of time before somebody pulled the plug on that company, and everybody along with it was going to be out of a job. So while the wrestlers didn't really have any respect for me because they weren't close enough to see that the same way, on the business side of things, I didn't have the same problem. They were much more willing to support me. Because they didn't need to have that kind of respect for me.
And from my perspective personally, back then, I remember at the time, and I can't remember really what was going on, and as your book, I did have a history of nagging injuries, so I can't remember, but I think I was completely healthy at the time. But we were always on the road. We were on doing a pretty heavy road schedule, but I was still relatively new to the business myself. I think I'd probably been in the business 3, at the most 4 years. So I was really still just kind of nose to the grindstone, approaching the task at hand, the mechanics of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And Stunning Steve was never a great character or gimmick, but I was still learning the trade, the craft, and all that. And I remember when you got the nod, I didn't think, oh, I can't believe this guy got the job. I was like really ambivalent because I didn't really, and there was no disrespect on my part. I wasn't thinking, who is this guy? He hadn't done. I grew up. I was a fan of yours when you was in as a fan of the business, a fan of yours. What you were doing at AWA and seeing you come through, and hey, we hit it off on a casual level. But from my end, I was just like, okay, there's a new cat in charge. And anyway, so our soap opera would happen the way it would happen another couple of years. So here you are, and there we go, and it's business at hand. And so, what was your first steps that you did to?
Well,
get the ball rolling the way you saw fit.
And this is going back to one of your questions on Tuesday, which is, do you enjoy the business the same way, or would you enjoy it the same way today as you did back then? And back then, I knew what the mission was, Steve. The mission was made really clear to me right from the get-go, which is, if this company doesn't fucking make some money, quick, this company is going to be gone. There's no more bullshit here.
Right.
It's got to make some money.
Right.
So I was late. You tell me what the mission is. If I have to go outside and eat the tree outside your window and there's a reason I have to do that, then I'm going to eat the tree. Yeah. I'll find a way. So I was very aggressive about that. And people either lined up along with me or they didn't. And it was pretty easy for me to figure out. The biggest challenge then that I had, it wasn't even the wrestlers and some of the more established guys, not guys like yourself, but guys that have been around by,
they
at that time
have
a long
different
time.
Perspective than
they
I
had.
Did.
Yes, yeah. They did. That was what it was, and I dealt with it how best I could. And I could put people in between me and them at that time because I had the Dusty Rhodes and I had different people that I put in that spot to keep me from it and protect me from it to a degree. But on the business side, I literally made people, and this is the funny part about this shit, bro, is the rap, the narrative, as they say now, on me was like, oh, you just spent Ted Turner's money. That's bullshit. There was no money to spend when I took over.
Right.
What I did, knowing that, and it was one instance when I made everybody out of a meeting, I made everybody go into their offices and count how many pencils, how many pens, how many magic markers they had. Because if you don't know what your asset, my thinking was, if you don't know what your assets are, then how are you going to build on them? If you don't even know what you have, how can you make it bigger? And we were just cutting costs, and this is what ultimately led to me getting control of the company. I pushed the issue about cutting costs and managing the budget because of the live event side of our business at that time. They were doing 120 or 160 or 180 live events a year, and every one of them was losing money. So the method behind that madness was, well, let's go out and do more live events because every time we go out the door, we lose money. And I said, well, what are you going to multiply that times 1,000?
Right.
You're just going to lose more money.
Right.
Shut down live events. Quit doing live events. But all of your resources, whatever they are, however many pencils and pens and notepads you have, put them into the television product and create the demand. Then take it out on the road. Don't keep losing money going out on the road. Well, that put me in direct conflict with a ton of people, including Bob Dew, who was then the executive vice president, and he happened to be the guy that was running the Omni at the time. And we fought, and we fought, and I won.
Right.
And we quit doing live events, and we shut down. We made it as small as we could, control the expenses, and slowly start to build it.
Hey, what was the first year we ended up going down to Orlando for those TV tapings?
That would have been about 94.
Okay. And that was your idea?
Yep. And that was part of the reason.
Right.
Because we couldn't keep taking the show out on the road. Every time and you remember this, you were there. We'd go out to these, we'd go to the Gainesville Arena, whatever the name of the Gainesville venue was. And 68 people would show up, and you'd turn off all the lights. We could have had a match in your living room. It would look better than that. We'd go to center stage, and three quarters of the people that showed up were going to have little brown paper bags and were falling asleep 20 minutes into the show.
Yeah.
We couldn't do that anymore.
Right.
And part of the making it mainstream was let's go down to Disney. Let's co-brand ourselves with Disney MGM Studios because people know what that is. They may not know us, but they know what that is. And let's leverage that.
So you're thinking that rub with Disney would help.
Exactly.
So in the book, Controversy Creates Cash, a hell of a book. I have a hard time reading. I read the thing from cover to cover in about 2-3 weeks. I'm proud of myself.
Lots of pictures.
Swig of beer. Buffalo Bill Cody for the working man. Eric Bischoff beer. It's a damn good beer. Were the Disney people that afraid of the wrestlers?
You said scared
they
didn't
want us on the park, just keep under wraps. I mean,
scared to death.
Yeah, or did they just think everybody's going to go crazy and just
scared to death? They didn't know what to
expect.
Scared
people off.
There was one guy there who was an advocate. His name was Bob Allen, young guy, and he believed for whatever reason. He believed. I'll never forget. I went into this pitch where I had to pitch Disney, bringing WCW there, and I was in a room by myself. I think David Crockett might have been with me. And we're in a room. It was a square room. It was like this room, a square rectangle. And there were seats all the way around the room. And I was in the middle. And I'm when you're pitching a room, you like to make eye contact with the people you're talking to, right? And I felt like an idiot on a pivot. I'm looking around. And everybody's sitting there with their arms crossed. They're kind of looking at me underneath their eyebrows. I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is going just horse shit. But Bob Allen pushed it through. But the conditions were, when we came on the lot, we had to come in a bus. People could come in cars. We had to tape over the windows in the bus
because
nobody wanted to see wrestlers on the property. Yeah. Once the wrestlers got to the building, they had to stay in the building. They couldn't walk around the park.
Right.
That was the rules. By the second or third year we were there, they were now letting us go into the different theme park areas and actually film because they realized that people love wrestlers. They love characters.
They end up being part of the attraction.
And nothing bad happened.
God, man, we had a blast there. I was at the time, I think my travel partner was Steve Regal. We stayed at some little shit box outside Kissimmee and found a British pub, Rover's Return Pub, and God dang, we had some good times there. It was a lot of fun filming TV at Orlando, but it was a little bit of a pain in the ass as far as you guys trying to keep a little kayfabe on.
It was impossible.
On the happenings, as it were, with the belts and stuff like that. And when you took over, Ole was booking.
Ole, yeah.
Was Ole booking and are on his way out? And then because on the
first... No, Ole was there. He was there, I adopted Ole.
Okay, you adopted him, but he had to go down the road, and then your next guy, that first trip to Disney was Dusty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Dusty believed.
Right.
Dusty believed. I think Ole might have been there for the first one. Ole was there for the first one. Ole made the big mistake one day. You remember Blackjack Mulligan, right?
Tell me this story, because you got a better account of that than I did.
Well, it's vague. I wasn't there. Okay. I'm repeating what I was told. Okay. But Blackjack was a very loyal guy, and I helped Blackjack. I helped him out in time when he needed help.
Right.
I didn't know I adopted him as a guardian angel at that time. I just did it because I thought it was the right thing to do. Yeah. And Ole made the mistake one day of going down to the power plant, and he started running his mouth, what an idiot I was. And Blackjack just went up to him, and I mean, Blackjack had a hand the size of a small refrigerator, knocked Ole completely out, like cold as potatoes.
Up, cold.
Just knocked him out cold. And that was pretty much the end of Ole.
See, I had heard about the scuffle, but I never knew the reason behind the scuffle. So in reading your book, I was like, that's what it was about. Mm-hmm. It was about Blackjack taking you back because the guy was running you down the
back. It was just
bad
mouth. I mean, he just did it in front of the wrong guy.
It was so fun because I was such a fan of Ole and Arn in the ring, the Andersons. I mean, one of the greatest tag teams of all time. And I love sitting there talking to Ole. And you know Ole, I mean, he's totally politically incorrect, but he's a barrel of monkeys to talk to. Knows the business like the back of his hand, but did he get trapped in maybe a little too old school for the situation?
He knew parts of the business.
Okay.
He knew parts of the business like the back of his hand.
Right.
He didn't know the television side of the business. He didn't understand the advertising side of the business.
He's just talking about straight up booking on a ledger.
Yeah.
Business. Okay. And not the big picture. You were seeing it in your head.
Yep.
And so then Dusty comes and we go down there. So what was it about Dusty's booking that you liked? Because from Dusty, you went to Flair with the book.
Yeah, Dusty had vision and still does to this day.
And I love Dusty, and I'm sure you do too. I mean, he's one of my favorite pro wrestlers of all time.
And people. I mean, he's a good guy.
But Dream, if you listen to this, I still got one match left in me, brother. All you got to do is look me up. I'll see you down in Orlando very soon. Go ahead.
Dusty had vision and Dusty had passion. And I loved, you know, what he saw. He wasn't the greatest on executing sometime and follow-up, but had the vision. He left a, I don't want to sound like I'm picking on him because it was common time.
No,
but it was sometimes the vision was so big that if you didn't think about the details and the execution of the big vision fell flat on its ass.
Okay.
And that happened a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and... You know, I tried with Dusty, but it just didn't work out. And I brought Flair in almost for more political reasons, quite honestly, than creative reasons. I needed somebody that talent would have faith in. And, you know, you can judge that or not. But to me at that time, Rick was the in-ring guy that at that point a lot of people trusted.
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
All right, I'm sitting there shooting the breeze here at 316 Gimmick Street with Eric Bischoff. He's over here at the crib. Let's talk a little bit about booking, because you talk about it a little bit in your book, Controversy Creates Cash, and I think you're probably a little bit better than I am at seeing the big picture. Well, I'm good at if you give me the whole territory and tell me what we're doing, I can take my angle and probably make it better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't see the big picture as well as someone else would. You could see that big picture or have a vision of it, but couldn't execute it yourself. You needed the help to do that.
Right.
Had you been able to dedicate more of your time to focusing on that and with a piece of paper or a chessboard, put the pieces in place better?
I didn't have the confidence.
Right.
I didn't have,
it's tough.
It's different.
Yes.
It was very different. And I never saw myself as the booker, the head writer, the head of the creative. I never saw myself as that guy. I didn't want to be that guy.
Right.
And I didn't have any confidence in my ability to be that guy, which is why I kept leaning on whether it was Dusty, whether it was Kevin Sullivan, whether it was Ric Flair. I never wanted to put myself in that spot because I didn't have the confidence in myself to do it.
Yeah, but also, you know, along with that, when you're sitting there, basically if you're talking to an artist and you're telling this artist what you want to be drawn, they'll attempt to draw that for you. Whether they're able to execute that to your likings is a whole different story. And much is the same with booking. I mean, I think it was an interview I listened to a few days ago where you're talking to some, you know, a lot of the internet people. I don't want to run them down, love them to death. But, you know, they think that, oh, just sit down and do this and put this guy there and push this guy and it's that simple. Mm-hmm. It ain't.
No.
It's probably the toughest job, you know, in the business.
It is. And it wasn't until really towards 96 where, and it wasn't out of choice, it was out of necessity, and it was out of a vision I had for, you know, the NWO and where I felt Nitro could go, that I said, screw it, I've just got to do this myself. I can't rely upon somebody else to interpret my vision for me. Right. I have to interpret it myself.
Okay, 96. I was just gone to WWF. So that means I got fired. I remember it was the third week. It was a three-week tour of Japan. Myself, Arn Anderson, Ron Simmons, Chris Benoit, Dean Malenko. I think Eddie Guerrero was on that trip. A lot of American guys. We had it was a great trip, but a 3-week tour of Japan is a 3-week tour of Japan. me and Arn drank a lot of beer. On the third night, I jumped off on a Japanese wrestler. He moved. I tore my tricep off my right elbow. I wrestled for 2.5 weeks like that because that's what you did. And again, going back to, I did have some nagging knee injuries back in the day, and it was all a shoot. Never worked an injury, but I did have some knee issues. So anyway, I was about damn near 3/4 through the healing process, and I read your book. And it's funny because y'all wanted me to appear at a TV taping and just cut a promo.
Mm-hmm.
Had the bad wing. And I think I'd volunteered to come down or do something at something prior to that. And someone said, oh, don't worry about it, whatever. So I think that had kind of gotten up my crawl a little bit. But on the phone call, you said that, that, who was it, Tony Schiavone called the house or somebody called the house?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you my perspective if it's okay with
no,
you.
No, go ahead.
So what I remember, and this is what I think what your listeners are anxious to hear, is we're at Center Stage. I was hoping you were going to stay on the roster. There were issues, but I was never too tough on physical injuries and issues. We'd get around him. But it was like, okay, we got to get Steve on TV. We got to keep the character alive. Can't put him in a match, can't do this, can't do that. But we can shoot an interview so at least the character's still alive. And thought we had everything laid out. Now, I knew at the time WCW was kind of a clusterfuck, and it could have easily been miscommunicated. And I, to this day, I believe I knew that then, and I'm sure I knew it now. But we said, okay, Steve's not here. Schiavone, because he was a producer. Get Steve here. Schiavone came back to me, said, called, wife answered. I could hear him in the background. He ain't coming. Well, that's kind of bullshit.
Yeah.
So I, being me, I took the attitude I took and made the decision I made. Right, wrong, good, bad.
No, had I been in your shoes and Eric Bischoff had been healing up from a tricep injury and I would have heard him say, tell the some bitches I ain't home in the background. And that probably is true. But I can't remember, but it probably is. But I'd have come to the same conclusion. But also, and looking at the, when I look back now, I was able to achieve a lot of Stone Cold Steve Austin. As Stunning Steve, I was a hell of a mechanic in the ring. I think I had the respect of my peers and the guys that I was out there on the road with. And, hell, I remember one time before, my WCW days, riding down to a town in Tennessee with Dr. Tom Pritchard and, Brian Lee, Primetime Brian Lee. And Tom Pritchard looked at me, he goes, what's so stunning about Stunning Steve? And I was like, I couldn't answer. I didn't know. I was busy trying to learn the mechanics of what goes on in a ring. I hadn't thought about what makes Stunning Steve stunning. And neither did Brian Lee have any idea why he was Primetime Brian Lee, other than it sounded like a pretty cool name. So anyway, when I look back, and when I first came in and able to take the world television title off Bobby Eaton, one of my favorites of all time, it was a tremendous honor. And I was a pretty good hand in the ring. But, man, when you look at what I'd turned into, I was losing my hair, had the goofy gimmick haircuts, had some injuries, and had that phone call gone down like that, and it most likely did. Like I said, there's many parts before we rolled the recorder, as I told you straight up, there's a lot of my parts of my career that I forgot. But had I been in your shoes and saw what I seen, now had I seen a guy that just had all the makings of superstar flashing on him, I might have saved that guy. But given the task at hand and the situation that was, I'd have done the same damn thing you did. So, and at the time I was mad. And, for a long time, I mean, that was some of the fuel that fed my fire when I went to ECW and cut some of the promos that I did. It was just out of pure frustration, not with the situation that happened, but also the situation that I let myself, get into. And
But see, let me interrupt you right there.
Yeah.
And it's easy for us now to have a beer and go back and look at things from our different perspectives. But this is where, you know, when I, before I got here, I asked, you know, my Twitter followers, I only got 150,000 of them. You've got 2.3 million. But I asked him, what do you want me to ask Steve Austin? So based on everything you're telling me right now, when did you know, when did you feel, not know, when did you feel in your head that Stone Cold Steve Austin, the character, was beginning to emerge? Was it immediately after that? Was it months, a year? How did that happen?
Man, it was probably, I didn't know at the time, but when Paul Lee calls me, I guess I'd been fired for about a week, and the phone rings, and Paul Lee calls me, he goes, hey, man, want to off your job, come to work at ECW. I said, shit, Paul, I can't work. I said, my arm's busted. He goes, you ain't got to work, cut promos. So I said, okay. You know, I started flying up there. You know, once a week I'd go to Philly, and we'd film some promos in the bottom of the, where there's an ECW arena or there in the hotel, you know, early in the mid-hours of the morning. All the guys been partying, drinking, doing their thing. And at least I was able to start venting some of the frustration that I had felt. And, you know, a part of it was that I'd let myself, you know, become used to the situation at hand. And a lot of the nagging injuries, you know, finally started healing up. But I guess that was where Paul Lee was able to take me and give me a little bit of a focus or an identity and who I am as an athlete, what I always consider myself. I live out here in Los Angeles, California. I do some acting. I prefer reality television, but I'm not an actor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an athlete. I'm a pro wrestler. Always was, always will be. So finally, in a competitive environment, you know, I was given, you know, that opportunity to shine. And, man, I'll chop somebody's head off to, you know, to kick and claw and scratch to get to the top. And I was given that freedom there in ECW. So I was venting, and you were a natural target. And, you know, I took a few shots at Hogan, who was never, you know, seemingly the target. When he was brought in, I signed a different contract because, you know, everybody thought their pay-per-view, you know, money was going to go up. I got a flat fee because I didn't see it happening. And, again, as I say this, I talked with Hulk on the WrestleMania 30 there in New Orleans. Had a great short conversation with him because everybody always thinks that there was heat between myself and Hulk Hogan. And two very competitive individuals in mm-hmm. the environment, you're not going to give each other too many props because that's just not what you do. But when you take a chance, when you take a step back and you get out of it, you know, there's never any heat with myself and Hogan. I was, even when I was not a nobody, but hardly anybody in WCW, I was competing with that guy.
Sure.
You know, I wanted to be the best. And finally, as Stone Cold Steve Austin, the run that I had was not that long, but very intense and white hot. The run that Hogan had lasted over 30 years, probably the best in the history of the business, with worldwide, you know, name recognition. Had a good chance to talk to him. But so I was very competitive with that guy and protective of my own legacy. But I guess the genesis was, you know, ECW and you know, getting honed with Paul Lee and mm-hmm. being able to direct some focus and thinking, okay, as a person, as an athlete on the field, in the game of football, I have that killer instinct. You know, I'm going to go for broke. I'm going to give you everything I got. And finally, I was able to do that. And I think finally I started getting that direction. And then when they started censoring my interviews, when we started going live every other week, because we needed to save money, so we'd film that one episode and put it in the can. And when I watched that episode back, I knew of Monday Night Raw. That's when they started chopping my lines out. And as we were walking the TV one day in Lowell, Massachusetts, somewhere like that, and I saw Vince walking down the towards the building. And didn't hardly know Vince at the time. Been in the company about a year and a half. And I said, hey, Vince, you got a second? And he said, yeah, Steve, I do. I said, hey, man, I got a question for you. I said, I notice that when I'm cutting my promos, you guys editing out a lot of stuff I say. I said, why is that? He goes, well, quite frankly, Steve, you're popping a lot of guys in the truck. Well, hell, you know as well as I do, Eric, you can pop a guys in the truck who have seen and heard everything. You could pop anybody. So I told Vince right then. I said, Vince, I'll tell you what. I said, you got guys here 6'10", 7 feet, 300, 330 pounds. I said, I'm 6'2", 250, black boots, black trunks, bald head and a goatee. I said, if you give me my personality, I said, I can compete with anybody you got. But if you take it from me, I said, I can't compete. He goes, all right, Steve. So that's when he started uncensoring my promos. So that's when I think, you know, the
creative. It's interesting now when you, I mean, you know, do you remember when You and I worked together in WWE.
God damn, that was a blast.
And it was. It's one of the highlights of my career, actually. Because and I was thinking.
Go ahead, continue.
I was thinking on the way here. I said, last time I physically laid eyes on Steve, it was right after the match we had in Montreal, where he was just stomping the piss out of me.
But professional.
But professionally. Yeah. And I loved that match, and I loved it for not because of my performance, because I didn't really do anything, but nor was I capable of it. But the fact that you and I overcame all of this crap,
yeah,
and gave the audience what they wanted to see and had a level of trust, even though there was no reason to, yeah, other than the fact that we probably are more alike than we are different, was a big deal for me. And I thought, well, that was the last time I saw him. But we talked in Texas because Bruce Prichard and I were down there, and I was doing this storyline, which was basically, there was one idea that I threw at Vince that he liked, and you pulled me aside, which was the very first time you and I had laid eyes on each other since, we split up. It sounds weird, but since you got fired. But
in a professional way.
Professionally speaking. But you pulled me aside, and, we talked about that. It was so freaking cool. That was a big moment for me, just so you know.
Yeah. Well, but then by the same token, by the time I had everything to digest and be what it was, again, like I said, looking at all I saw back in the day was an athlete in the ring. Not a great gimmick, losing his hairline. I didn't see superstar. When I look back, and I'm Stone Cold Steve Austin, when I look back and see that guy, I'm thinking, good mechanic, that's it.
So, but it tastes that magic, and you know it now.
Yeah.
It's easy for you now to look back at your character and see how it became that character. But that's a part where, people ask me, and I'm sure they ask you all the time, when's the next big star? Why can't you just make another big star? Dude, first of all, if it was easy, you and I'd be doing it. We'd be throwing coconuts at each other on a beach somewhere in Maui. It's not easy. It's hard.
It's not easy, but also, I asked, sent on my Twitter account, you're E. Bischoff on Twitter. I'm Steve Austin, BSR. And I sent out, hey, man, if you guys got questions, and you said the same thing, send them in and we'll answer them for you. And then I keep getting the same old things, and you do too. And it's, how do you feel firing the biggest superstar in the history of professional wrestling, or one of the biggest superstars in the history of professional wrestling? Hey, at the time, who would have thunk it? Who would have fucking knew? Because I damn sure didn't either. I knew I was hungry. I wanted to be that. But, man, looking at what I was presenting, and we're going to get off this subject, but looking at what the product was in the ring, looking at the circumstances, the way they were happening, looking at my history of injuries, I'd have done the same damn thing. So I respected your decision. Now that it's over, I respect your decision. I can see why. And we both know now that it was the best thing that
best
ever happened
everybody.
To me. And so
that's for everybody.
But let's go back to you now. That's what happened. We buried the hatchet a long time ago when we did those skits in Bandera, Texas. We're sitting here drinking Buffalo Bill, Cody beer, Eric Bischoff's beer. It's in 4 states. It's going to be in 6 here pretty quick. And then making some rounds and getting it. It's damn good beer. If you can find some, I recommend you buy some. So let's talk about the Monday Night Wars.
Cool.
Y'all go down there. And you have a meeting with Ted Turner, and he says, hey, man, really the only way to compete, and you say, is to
go live. Monday night, prime time. Go ahead
and. And you didn't think you had a chance in hell to get that?
No, because I didn't. That's not what I was there for. I was there to try to get Ted's permission to do a deal with Rupert Murdoch for Chinese television that no one in this country was ever going to see or even know about. But Rupert Murdoch and Ted Turner had.
Dude, you think of China way back in the day? That's smart.
Yeah. they offered money.
Yeah.
But Murdoch and Turner hated each other at the time, and I couldn't go do that deal without getting permission, or I'd be out of a gig.
Right.
So I talked to Scott Sassa, who was the heir apparent at the time. I said, please help me do this deal, because I knew it would be the one deal that would turn WCW into a profit center for the first time in her history. And once I got past that point, I knew I'd be gold. So set up, did all my research, had my pitch down, and I had met Ted once or twice at like a cocktail party and crap like that. But I knew he would have stepped on me in a lobby and not known who I was. Got all geared up. Harvey Schuller was there. Scott Sassa was there. I get about a minute and a half or 2 minutes into my pitch. Shuts me down. Says, Eric, what do we got to do to catch Vince McMahon? It's like, fuck. I felt like I was in a ring with, you know, Mike Tyson and Oscar De La Hoya out all at the same blue. Time, out of the blue.
Out of the blue, you're talking about China, and he hits you with what's going to take to compete with McMahon.
I did a little bit of boxing in my life. I knew if I don't tuck my fucking chin and cover right now, I'm going down. So I went, tucked my chin and just started babbling. And I came up with just go head-to-head with Vince McMahon because it was the only logical answer, the only defensible answer.
Did he flinch? What happened?
No. He said, Scott. Which, by the way, Scott Hessler was like this young, up-and-coming, hip, cool superstar, you know, take over for Ted Turner soon kind of guy that didn't want anything to do with wrestling. He looked over at his guy and said, Scott, give Eric 2 hours every week, prime time on TNT, Monday night. And TNT at the time was like the hood ornament of the Turner organization. Scott just, I could see him. He just was like, he got rigor mortis sitting there in a chair. But that was it. It's like once Ted said it, there was no arguing about it. Just do it. And I walked out of that. I walked out of that meeting, and I literally stood in the hallway, and I went, "Now what the fuck am I going to do?" Because I asked for it,
right?
And I got it. Right. Now what do I do with it?
Okay, once again, in uncharted waters. How do you navigate those waters?
I knew I knew the people around me weren't into it. I knew I either had people that were hoping I would fail or people that were afraid I was going to fail. I didn't really have anybody that I could go to. So I literally went into a room by myself a couple hours later, and I made a list. I said, okay, I can't be better than the WWF. There's no freaking way.
And you say that why?
It's just my instinct. And I don't know where I got this or how it came to be a part of my consciousness, but I've known all my life that you either need to be better than or different than.
Right.
You got to be one or the other.
And maybe to your point, and maybe you tell me if I'm resonating in the right thing here, it's going to be hard to be better than him out of Jump Street because...
He was too big.
Yeah, he's too big, but he's been doing it a while.
He's 30, 35 years in the market between him and his dad. And I mean, there's history in the Northeast.
So I can dig that answer. Go ahead.
And there was no way this young... kind of upstart, relatively new company that was kind of regional, was going to be better than this national franchise.
Yeah, gotcha.
But I knew I could be different than them.
Right.
So I literally sat in a room and made a list of every single way I could think of, and some of them were good, some of them not so much, where I could be different than him. It was just not being better, it was being different.
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
All right, here we are, sitting here drinking Buffalo Bill Cody beer. There's a bunch of them in the freezer. The task at hand is to lay down some audio whoop ass, and that's happening with relative ease, and I'm hanging out with Eazy-E. Before we continue with the conversation, how long have you had the nickname Eazy-E?
Scott Hall gave that to
me
somewhere.
I knew Scott Hall gave you that. I was going to say, one of two people gave you that name. Scott Hall was going to be my first. Kevin Nash going to be my second.
No, it was Scott Hall. Yeah, it was Scott Hall.
God dang, how smart is that guy?
He's amazing. He is amazing. And I've said this before, and I'll say it, and I owe it to him. We owe it to him. He needs to hear this again. When his head was right, he had more instinct and better vision and a better feel for this business than anybody I've ever met, bar none.
Dude, it's funny, through DDP, Diamond Dallas Page, our mutual good buddy, you know, I started calling Scott Hall every here and there, and I'll just ring him out of the blue, and I've probably only had maybe 4 conversations with him on the phone. It's not like we're phone buddies, but we'll just start talking about the business for 10, 15, 20, and you'll hear some stuff come out of that guy's mouth. It's like, holy shit, and I've been around the horn a few times. I've been pretty damn high and started pretty damn low. And you hear his spin on things. It reminded me a lot of riding down the road with Ravishing Rick Rude because he loved to talk about the business. They kind of had the same mind, but Scott even deeper so than even Rick. And so I agree with you. Just the way he talks about things, and sometimes he'll talk about a match and he'll go into too specifics. He'll start talking about percentages and he'll start talking about finishes. But a great mind for the goddamn
amazing
business.
And when NWO was really first getting going, and it was a collaboration, believe me.
Whose idea was it to start the NWO?
It was mine.
Okay.
It was mine. But It was my idea originally, but that idea morphed. So the idea that I had was different than what we all saw on television because Scott got involved, because Kevin got involved.
Right.
You know what I mean? So nobody can claim ownership to it. I've read every. I mean, so many people have, you know, taken credit for that. It's gotcha. Ridiculous. But I'm here to tell you that there were meetings that we had in 96 and 97 when Scott was clear headed when he came in, and he would sit and we would start laying out stuff, and the shit that he came up with sometimes just made it almost took my breath away.
Right.
You know, he came up with the Sting Crow character. That was all Scott Hall. That wasn't Sting. That wasn't me. That was Scott Hall. He created that. I was in the room when he created that character.
Right.
Word for word. And Sting went out and did it, and it was magic. It was magic.
What'd Sting think?
Sting was open at the time because that was post in the NWO. He ended up not being the third guy, which he was going to be if Hogan right. wasn't going to do the deal. And he was looking for that one thing. He knew NWO was hot, but he right. knew it. He knew NWO needed, you know, a protagonist.
Right.
And he was going to be that guy.
Yeah.
And he loved Scott's vision of that character. It was cool.
So we're going head to head here, right? And it's Nitro versus Monday Night Raw. How long did it take you guys to catch up and pass us?
You know, I don't recall. I think we launched in 95, and by late 95 or early 96, we were there.
But when you launched, man, I read everything, but when y'all launched Nitro, Hall and Nash weren't there yet.
No.
How did you, because Hall was, I mean, yeah, Scott was the first guy to come down, right?
Yeah.
Contract expired. Kevin's was up, and then he was going to come down, too.
Came shortly thereafter.
Right. And so you always, and you... vehemently deny that you weren't the guys who was the first guy who was giving away guaranteed money. And you weren't. WCW was talking guaranteed money shit back in the early 90s, mm-hmm. guaranteed money. Because mm-hmm. the deal was back then, and you probably know this as well as I do, or a lot of guys who came in on the same deal. Back in the day, man, I started off in Dallas, Texas, starving like a sumbitch, USWA. All of a sudden, I go down to WCW before you got there, talking to Dusty Rhodes. They bring you in. They pay you $75 flat a year.
Mm-hmm.
The next year, if you anybody that's going to be a hand in the ring, they're going to jack you to $1.56. Why it was a $1.56, I have no idea. Some guys got the $1.04 deal. I got the $1.56 deal. And then from that point on, it was your negotiation of what you got. So guaranteed contracts was there before you got there.
Right.
They existed in the business. What people always, or what you always say, you weren't the guy, you know, giving out guaranteed money. What happened when Scott Hall and Kevin Nash went down was that was really the first time
big money
had been guaranteed, and a certain number of dates, and that was the game changer really from then on, because mm-hmm. these days, you know, guaranteed contracts. Everybody's got them in WWE, whether it's downside or whatever the deal is. That was the first time when someone could actually compete, you know, head to head and throw down a number that really got a guy's attention based on dollar amount and days on the road.
Yep. And you have to understand, and it's not because I wanted to necessarily.
Oh, yeah, God. You always want to pay someone as little as you can.
We had to. If we were going to compete with the WWF or E at the time, as Ted wanted us to. You know, WWF was a very mature business, and you know as well as I do to this day. I get a WWE licensing and royalty check, you know, once a quarter. I mean, even back then, you made a lot of money in royalties in WWF. WCW didn't have that.
Right.
So you either gave a guarantee that augmented or supplemented or replaced what you couldn't give them in licensing and royalties because WCW didn't have it. They weren't around long enough to establish it. You either matched it in a guarantee or you couldn't compete. We didn't have any choice. So when Scott became available, we offered him a guarantee that was probably not as much as he would have made had he worked 300 days a year
right.
and, you know, everything would have worked out perfectly.
In a perfect world.
But it was good. It was better than good.
Yeah.
Same with Scott. And it was working for us. Yeah. The math.
But also from a wrestler standpoint, when all of a sudden you're putting big money on the table and number of dates and is guaranteed, Very attractive.
Well, it is. And the other thing was the dates. I think I don't remember what it was, but I think it was 180 days was right. the maximum. Well, you know, to you and me right now, 180 days a year sounds like a lot because now you got to put yeah. travel on the front and back of that before you know it. You got a full calendar. But to those guys back then, because you were living it, 180 days a year was kind of like vacation.
Yeah, almost a half a year. I mean, really, that's how much it's.
It meant more than money.
Drastically different it is.
To guys that have been doing it for a long time, it meant more than money because you could have a life.
Because how did you like life on the road?
I was younger then. I liked it. You know, my family life was really solid. My wife was understanding. My kids were cool. I was probably 4 days a week, 5 days a week, off and on.
Pretty good load.
Yeah, because you remember we had, you know, back then when things were running, we had a 3-hour nitro. Then it became a 2-hour nitro. We had a 2-hour Live Thunder. So we had two.
Well, that was
live...
a kind of a bomb that got dropped in your lap.
As oh, well. God almighty.
Because you didn't want that to happen.
I hated it.
Let's stick with life on the road. You hang with anybody? Did you kind of.
Not anybody in particular. No, I mean, I like to hang at the bar. You know, I like to have beers.
Right.
I would, you know, I had friends at that time. You know, I there were a bunch of guys that I liked to hang out with. There was nobody that I was really close to.
Right.
You know, I became. You know, real close with Hulk, obviously. I was friends with DDP for a while. But there was nobody really that I hung out with. And right. it wasn't so much that I liked hanging with the boys as much as they were people that I worked with. They were people that you share stuff with. You're on the road together.
Right.
You know, it was
God dang,
I had a blast.
Back in, we was at war together, though. I mean, because those are you guys. Because, I mean, the wars got intense.
They were intense, but from our point of view then, this was our point of view, for all of us, not some of us, for all of us, it was the first, well, there was a couple guys. You know, take Hogan out of the equation and, you know, Macho out of the equation. But for all of us, it was the first time any of us had been near the top
right.
or on top.
Right.
In the sense of accomplishment. Was so great that I would have sat and drank beer with people that I couldn't stand and had a good time.
Right.
Because it was just an overwhelming feeling of accomplishment.
Was the feeling then when you guys got momentum and started kicking our ass, what was it, for 84 some straight weeks,
mm-hmm.
but then when you guys were beating us in the Monday Night Wars on the Nielsen ratings, was it the perception or was it in y'all's mind that y'all had now become the number one promotion? Because from the boys' level, from my level, and of course, I was WWF, the WWF was always the place to be. At that time, did y'all consider WCW the place to be?
I didn't. I never got really comfortable. And I'm going to tell you a story. There was a moment in time, and it was when we were at our peak or close to it, and we were in Detroit. We're at the Cobo Arena, I think. And I was in a limo with Hulk, and we had a big event going on. I don't remember which one it was. And he looked at me, and he's a really wise guy. And
very.
He looked at me, and he saw me getting a little full of myself.
Mm.
And he'd been down a couple of times.
Yeah, yeah.
And he saw me getting a little full of myself, and he said, "Brother, don't ever think that you're where you want to be, because enjoy this moment, because it can disappear before you know it." And I remember when he said that to me, I was thinking, why would you say that? Where did that come from?
Right.
Here we are doing what we're doing. Why would you say that? And, you know, it ended up becoming true. But I never really thought of us as being the place to be. I never thought we won. I was always aspiring to win, always wanted to be bigger. It was not a job that was completed. It was just a process.
So with dealing with Hulk Hogan, creative control over storylines. How tough was the dynamics of just trying to work within those parameters?
It really wasn't. You know, so much of that has been so overplayed. I've listened to the stories being told by so many different people that don't have a fucking clue what they're talking about. It really was. There was a couple occasions where it became an issue, but no different than it would have been with you when you were with Vince McMahon, and you didn't have creative control, but you did.
Well, yeah.
There are...
You talk about that in your book. But I'll tell you what, I've always been a pretty, you know, I've always wanted to do the right thing for business, but I'll tell you what, there's a lot of times. And Triple H got the heat for running me down in one of the interviews he did. He said, man, sometimes Stone Cold Steve Austin would roll into a building for Monday Night Raw, and they drop creative on him, and he'd just tell him, no, fuck you, well, I'm not doing that. And, you know, and he wouldn't offer a solution. And people thought that he was running me down. No, he was telling a true story. You know, if I didn't like something at the time, I'd say, no, I'm not doing that shit. And, well, what do you want to do? I don't know, but I ain't doing that. So Yeah, I was in the same place. It wasn't written in my contract.
No, it's not. It's not creative control legally, but it's as a character. When you're that successful, when you're that important, and when you're protecting your own character, which is what you were doing, and you had to, just like Hogan did. Here was Hogan's biggest thing: is you'd lay some shit on him. Guys would lay out stories, they'd lay out finishes, they'd lay out a program, whatever, and he'd listen. And he'd start doing this. He'd start stroking that Fu Manchu. And the minute you saw him reaching that Fu Manchu, you knew there was going to, the question was coming. And the question was always the same. Cool. Where do you go from there?
Right.
And if you didn't have that answer right there, right then, right. and it was clear and you've already thought about it, and he knew you were bullshitting, you wouldn't doing it.
Smart.
Because he knew that you didn't have a fucking clue what you were doing. You were just throwing a dart in the dark and hoping it was going to hit a target.
Well, yeah, you're playing checkers when you got to be playing chess. So he's looking for that next move. And Monday Nitro, when did y'all switch to Kevin Nash having a book?
That was towards the end when, quite honestly, I was fried. There were things going on the business side, internally at Turner, Time Warner, AOL, that my brain was in a freaking blender.
You're talking about when things kind of started going awry. It was the merger with Time Warner, AOL.
There were two. There was the Time Warner merger, which was a real challenge. And then when it became AOL, Time Warner just got ass ugly.
Okay, so what changed for you when that merger happened?
Again,
when the headaches began.
Oh yeah, but it's Time Warner is when it really began. I'll never forget this. I went to a Christmas party one time at Terry McGurk's house. Terry McGurk at the time was the CEO of Turner Broadcasting. And it was just a handful of executives and their families that got invited to this Christmas party. And I went to Terry McGurk's house, and everybody was there. And Gerald Levin, who was at the time the CEO of Time Warner, came in. And everybody toasted, and it was a big deal. And Gerald Levin said, you know, one of the greatest things about this merger is that we're going to take the stability and the magnitude of this Time Warner infrastructure, and we're going to infuse it with the entrepreneurial drive of the Turner organization, and together we're going to become unbeatable. And I believed it. Like, you got to prove to me that I can't believe you before I won't believe you.
Right.
I don't immediately distrust people. I immediately trust them. And when he said that, I went, God damn, this is going to be even better than it's been. And mind you, it was pretty good for me. I had Ted Turner's confidence. And I was so excited. And somebody else about a week later said, be careful, because here's how these corporate mergers work. It doesn't happen overnight, but slowly but surely, the company that buys the other company own it. They control it. Everything changes. And within months, I started seeing guys that were pretty loose, pretty cool, pretty creative, pretty entrepreneurial, people at my level and way above my level. All of a sudden, they're wearing blue suits, white shirts, red ties, wingtip shoes, walking and talking like their Time Warner counterparts. Well, this is ugly. And then the reality hit. They changed everything about the way we did business. And that was the beginning of the end. And that's about the time when I brought Kevin in, because my head was just, I was crushed.
So how did he do for you?
Kevin's a friend. You know, he wasn't really cut out to be a booker. He didn't, or, you know, had a creative. He didn't have the support. People looked at him as being, you know, taking care of himself. And it was a bad situation for him. His intentions were there.
Right, right.
And his capabilities are. Kevin's a bright, talented guy. And he could probably do it right now.
Right.
But back then, coming off of everything that we'd come through on the NWO and all the crap that went along with it, it was horrible timing for him.
Dude, it's damn near impossible to try to book Monday Nitro and then Thunder, 3 days later?
Yeah.
It was live TV.
It was live TV.
How draining was that second show? Because you already had enough on your plate. 2 hours of bust-ass live TV. And it was hot and heavy, head-to-head competition. And so all of a sudden you get another hours?
It was 2 hours.
Two hours?
And I knew it was the beginning of the end. And, and I'll never forget this. I was driving through Wyoming. I don't remember the year, but I was driving through Wyoming with my family, going to our place. And I got a phone call from my then boss, Harvey Schill. He goes, Eric, hey, how's the vacations? Great, Harvey. Hey, good news. Ted just called. He wants to do a 2-hour show prime time on TBS because, you know, TNT's doing so great. I didn't say fuck you, but I was thinking fuck you. because he was Harvey. He was a colonel in the military. I couldn't say fuck you. But I was thinking, oh, right, Harvey, cool. You know, good joke. Yeah. Okay, I'm on vacation. Leave me alone till I get back. Don't mess with me anymore. He's a good dude, by the way. And he goes, no, Eric, I'm not kidding. Ted wants another show. I said, Harvey, please tell me you're kidding. He said, I promise you, Eric, I am not kidding. When I hung up on the phone, I knew we were done because there's no way we could do it. Just didn't have the infrastructure. Creatively, talent-wise, I knew we were going to dilute ourselves. You just can't create. We couldn't. We couldn't create that much interest in our property.
Interest in property.
Thank you for joining us for another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show. Please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. For more Steve Austin Show, go to podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
All month long on Pluto TV, stream the biggest Tyler Perry movies free. Watch your favorites like Madea's Witness Protection and Madea's Big Happy Family. Join Tyler Perry as he goes on a couples retreat with Sharon Leal in Why Did I Get Married? Or Idris Elba and Gabrielle Union in the Tyler Perry-directed film Daddy's Little Girls. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies and TV shows available on live and on demand. Download the free Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in. Watch free.
Yo, what's up, guys? This is NBA champion Bobby Portis of the Milwaukee Bucks.
Bobby Portis and the Bucks.
Inside, Portis for the slam.
Here with my brand new podcast, Keep It A Buck. Each week, me, AB, and Barrette.
It's your boy, Blessed Up AB, man.
They call me Baby Tay, they call me Red Tay, they call me Barrette.
We'll be talking to special guests from fellow athletes, celebrities, and friends from all walks of life. And you know we'll keep it a buck.
So you saying you better than J. Cole?
J. Cole.
Cush J. Cole.
J. Cole, nice, though.
My floater is Hall
of Fame. Not knocking your game.
They got the watching guys like Chris Middleton and Giannis. Like, watching these guys like 300 makes a day.
Not, and I'm not talking about just shots.
Makes.
It just ain't going to come. Just because you're dreaming about it, you got to actually make it into a reality. You got to speak it into existence. You got to make your daily deposits every day.
Lunch meat.
Download new episodes of Keep It A Buck every Thursday, wherever you get your favorite podcast. Keep It A Buck. Peace.